from the Allstate Skyline Studio.
WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for December the 16th, 2018. The holidays growing ever closer. Welcome to our weekly look at the world of politics and policy as we go from City Hall to the State House and all the way to the White House. Time to grab that Sunday paper, get that cup of coffee. We'll do our best to get your week off to a good start. That fog is sure rolling in today, guys. I got to tell you that
the skyline looks really strange.
Yes.
Doesn't it?
Well, it was kind of when I got up and went over to catch my CTA 29 stretch limo this morning. I thought I was actually starring in The Exorcist. It was.
You were the priest at the bottom of the stairs.
Yes,
with the
light in the fog,
yeah.
Yes.
I wanted to take a picture of it just for the novelty of it, and I figured I could just take a picture of a blank screen and post that.
Yeah, because who would know?
Right, exactly.
I thought it was icy fog,
right,
too.
The sidewalks were a little slick.
Right, and so you've got, everybody driving in this, please be careful, but earlier when it was dark, I kind of even worried about crossing the street because mm-hmm. I wasn't sure people could even see the stoplights. It was tense out there.
What's interesting also is that, I was along State Street also coming into work a little earlier than you, and it wasn't that bad. So between the time I was out coming in and preparing for work to the time you were coming in, Rick, this fog just moved in like that.
Yeah, I thought maybe about we should do the show with the British accents because it was so much like a London type, London-esque type.
You know, now that you
a
say
foggy
that,
foggy day in Chicago time. Yes.
There was a headless horseman that walked right by when I was waiting for the bus.
Oh no, the holidays, Christmas, not Halloween.
That's true.
Come on, let's get in the proper spirit.
If you remember back in 1982, I'm going to date myself here, but we had a high Christmas day of 60-something.
Really?
Wow. Yep.
I don't remember that.
And a friend of mine and his father had Christmas dinner, and they excused themselves from the table and said, we're going
to
go play nine holes of golf.
That's awesome. Yep.
I don't remember 1982, but I do remember not too far away a Christmas that I talked about it on the air yesterday. I feel like it was almost 60. I remember taking out the garbage in my gym shorts, and I was like, this is a fantastic feeling.
I've seen people out with shorts on last couple of days.
Well, yeah, that's just Chicago.
That's Chicago,
too.
Yeah,
but you got to have the temperatures at least. If you're not going to have the snow, you have to have the temperatures. I was down in Austin, Texas during 2000 for the famous Count the Chads in Florida during the recount. I was covering George W. Bush's campaign then, and I didn't get back until Christmas Eve from Austin. But on Congress Street, in front of that leads to the Texas State Capitol, there's this great music store. And you would hear them constantly playing Christmas carols, and it's beginning to look a lot like Christmas, and it's 82 degrees.
Yes, right, right.
Melikamiki Maka.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's just very good. Joe, very good. But it just, you got to have the temp at least.
Yeah, I was in L.A. once around this time in December, and it was about 75 or 80 degrees, and seeing lights in palm trees was a little different.
That's got to be kind of a bizarre look,
yeah,
too.
But, yeah.
Well, so the fog, I guess, is supposed to clear out between 8 and 9 o'clock.
Yes, this dense fog advisory runs until 10, and it really does cover the entire area here. Boone, Cook, DeKalb, DuPage, Grundy, Kane, Kendall, Kankakee, Lake County, Illinois, Will County, Ford and Iroquois. So, you know, the whole area.
Little London,
as they say,
too.
It's got you covered.
Well, I was kind of curious about, would we get another fog bowl?
Oh, that'd be fantastic.
Don't you think?
Ooh, I don't know, though. I don't know if you want... I feel like you don't want anything to distract the Bears right now from accomplishing what they need to accomplish today.
They've got a big game.
We know what they have to accomplish today.
Right.
And it's about winning the division today.
It's supposed to be... correct me if I'm wrong, Dave, but... I mean, a high of 48 today over there?
In the mid-40s, yes. Could easily hit 48. We got up to, what, 45, 46 yesterday in spots? So, sure, it could happen.
Tell you what, that's going to be a little off balance. A Bears-Packers game in December at 48 degrees.
Well, this
could
be...
Rather than cold and snow in
the
air.
This could be reverse bear weather.
Right.
Because it's in Green Bay. It might be too warm for
them. I was just going to say, it's too warm for the Packers today.
You know you're going to see a picture from the tailgate of guys in, like, swim trunks and beach chairs.
Yes. But we got to win today. We absolutely have to win today. And I haven't even looked at what the spread is.
Are they're still getting six, no?
Green Bay?
Yes.
We're giving six.
But that's what I'm... Yeah, Green Bay is getting six.
Wow.
That's what I... That last time I
checked,
that's
good.
What it was.
We're that good. How about that? When's the last time the Bears against Green Bay and the Bears are given points?
I feel like... Well, I want to say once they got Khalil Mack, they were the favorite for the opener.
For that opener?
But then once it came closer to the season, I'm pretty sure the Packers were given the Packers were giving three.
Yeah, I gotta think, but wow, this is...
Well, again, it's the first time the Bears are trying to beat Green Bay at Soldier Field for the first time since September 2010.
Jeez.
Wow.
That was the year they won Monday night, and then the Packers won the season finale, gave them the wild card, they went to the playoffs, and then obviously beat the Bears in the NFC North,
right.
Or the NFC Championship, and then went on to win the Super Bowl.
2010. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that hurts.
Right. But maybe not today.
Oh,
it won't hurt today.
I am.
Yeah, that
all...
was 8 years ago.
Thanks for that quick addition.
I'm good.
Dave pulled out the abacus to figure that one out.
No, I've got the calculator on the computer right here in front of me.
Verifying. Yep. 8 checks out. Yep, he's right.
He is right. Okay, good. I want to make sure. We do facts on this show. You know that's...
carry the one.
Oh.
Divide by six.
Well, you gotta think for the retailers here in the city. You don't want it to be 48 degrees and the Bears playing the Packers, because if it was just 48 degrees or the Bears were playing the Packers at a night game, the stores, I mean, the stores are going to be filled anyway.
Right.
But you would think today, you know, a big Sunday shopping day. I mean, even yesterday out here downtown on State Street and Michigan Avenue was packed. But I got to think the Bears are going to take away some of that retailing a little bit, don't you think?
Probably. I'm sure there will be a lot of couples walking down Michigan, and, you know, then a few hours will pass by and the husband will veer off towards the lakefront and maybe try and snag a tailgate or something like that.
Or search out a underground saloon on lower Michigan Avenue.
Very true.
What do you have in mind, Rick?
I think you can probably guess.
Sounds like you're speaking from experience.
Yeah, a little, just stopping for a double cheeseburger, that's all, you know. But truly, 48 degrees, wow, that's fantastic. What? So do you guys have the Christmas shopping done? Because I don't.
I'm almost done.
Really?
I'm almost done.
Boy, I've done like little bits and pieces, but I haven't done the whole deal.
I'm almost done. I know what I have to do, and I just have to go out and get it done. Fortunately, I got things done a bit on the early side this year, because I will have no time this week. So For once in my life, I was organized.
Good for you. We're all very happy for you, Dave, because I am just the complete opposite. And the other thing is, you know, in the past it was, oh, I'd love to get my mom this, I'd love to get my aunt this, but I didn't have any money. Now I'm like okay with buying presents. I just don't know what to get anybody. That's the difficult part.
Gift cards.
That's true.
Yeah.
I mean, I hate to do it, too. I hated that idea, but, I mean, that's what my daughters really ask for. Because I guess I have such horrible taste.
I got Dad, just a gift card would be fine.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like, thanks for trying, but how about gift cards next year?
I got something called a Yifty or a Gifty or something like that. Any idea? And I checked it out.
Yifty?
Yeah. I had no idea what it was, and I ththought it was, you know, a potentially hazardous email. So I texted the friend who sent it. I said, is this from you? And he said, yes, it's from me. But yeah, it was a Yifty. And it kept getting prompts saying, don't forget to open your Yifty. And so it was, in fact, from him. And it was a gift certificate to a business here in Chicago.
Oh, an email certificate.
Yeah, yeah.
A Yifty. So it was a
Yifty. Yeah, I was waiting on pins and needles to say what it was.
Y-I-F-T-Y.
Yeah. Okay. Well.
That was new to me.
There's... I mean, how many different startups are there and all of that kind of thing? Wow. I guess the hardest part is going to be for me to go over to like Walgreens and buy gift cards. That might be the, you know.
They have a whole rack of them over there.
Yeah, I know. Yes, I know.
Yeah, I'll take the left column.
Yeah, right. One from this column, one right.
The middle column.
Yes. So I do have a couple of trinket things that I did buy them. But,
are you also getting those at Walgreens?
Trinket thing? No, those were not from Walgreens. No, no, not at all.
Like, yeah, I'll throw a chapstick and maybe a bag of throat lozenges.
Those little hand warmer packets and things. Yeah.
I knew you would love these this
right.
year.
Right, the multi-box of Band-Aids, you know.
colored pencils.
Dr. Scholl's foot powder, you know, all the gifts that keep on giving. That's what I believe. But I treated myself. I bought a new TV. And I thought it'd be great with the Bears now and everything.
You filled me in on this. This sounds like a very nice unit.
And, well, and I'm sure it's like a year old model or whatever, but I mean, I literally paid nothing for it. And it's, you know, Wi-Fi. It's more powerful than like the first computer I ever bought for $3,500 from Gateway back in the mid 80s.
How big is it?
55.
There you go.
Do you have rabbit ears for it?
Well, actually, I still don't have it connected to the cable yet. So I am, in essence, using the rabbit ears.
Okay.
Right now.
So you're just staring.
No.
Black TV.
No, I'm using.
Isn't this a beautiful picture?
I'm a bit more advanced than that. No, I'm using the over-the-air antenna, so I'm getting the direct HD signal.
Oh, you're one step away from the rabbit ears.
Well, and you know they sell like HD over-the-air antennas.
Right.
And
right.
You know what they really are? They're UHF antennas.
Oh, yeah.
If you have an old UHF antenna, it's HD, believe it or not.
Hmm. So it's part of that bandwidth.
Right. But it's also a Wi-Fi enabled TV.
That's smart TV, right?
Smart TV. And in going through a sub menu of this thing, I found out that it is also, you can't use the name of the Amazon product because I don't want to set off people's Amazon product. But it is Amazon enabled. So I can tell my smart device.
On the TV.
I can tell my little Echo Dot to turn off the TV, on the TV, turn on Amazon Prime, turn on Netflix.
See, back in my day, we had these things called remotes.
Now, this is what I like from Joe, like back in my day. Yeah, back in my day.
And sometimes you would misplace it.
Back growing up, I was the remote control, okay? I was my dad's remote control.
That's true.
I mean, yeah, back in the day. Well, it's great where you can just tell the TV to turn itself off, to, you know, turn the volume up. It's great. Don't you think?
Absolutely. We are spoiled as a generation now with
now,
things like
now
that.
If there was only something to watch.
What's the old Springsteen song? 500 channels and nothing's right. on?
Speaking of TV, so I was on my Twitter feed, and I was reading this thing about the TV show Friends, which is like how old now?
It's like, that stopped in 2004.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And it like began in 94, right?
Yes, yeah, I want to say that's the time frame.
Okay, so when the stars of Friends, they negotiated their contracts together as a group. And one of their contracts that they negotiated was for a 2% share of the rights going forward.
Wow. Okay? How smart was that?
Do you know how much they're getting paid a year?
I don't want to know.
Because Warner Brothers struck a $1 billion syndication deal for Friends reruns, okay? $20 million each a year.
Goodness.
A year?
A year.
Wow.
$20 million each. I never was that crazy about the show. I mean, it was, you know, $20 million a year.
It is kind of a unique audience. Not unique, but you know, there's a pretty registered sample size there.
Oh, look, it had a big audience. I mean, their finale drew like 52 million people.
It's a big hit on Netflix too. I want to say it's probably only second to The Office or something right now.
Yeah, I mean, 20 million a year in syndication.
Isn't that the way it goes though with TV shows, that the actors make more money once the show's over with and the reruns are played?
Now, but back in the day,
okay,
not everybody got a cut of the reruns.
Because I feel like, how much money is Jerry Seinfeld making?
Right. Oh, sure. I can imagine.
Because how many channels play Seinfeld, you know?
The same number that used to play Andy Griffith, I think.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
It was all over the place. But, yeah, so there's your today's TV trivia. $20 million apiece for the stars of Friends. It's an amazing economy we have here in the United States of America. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Joe's here with the latest sports. Producer Kassira is fielding your calls at 312-981-7200. You can text us at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at Sunday Spin. Engineer Bob is looking for the remote control. And remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. And you can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Up ahead on your Sunday Spin, after the 7:30 news, we're going to speak to my good friend Don Schaefer. Don's the head of he's the executive vice president of the Midwest Truckers Association. We'll talk to him about this call last week by Mayor Rahm Emanuel, along with some others, about seeking a increase in the state's gasoline tax to fund a massive public works program. We haven't had one in a decade. And, you know, raising gas taxes is the way it's normally done. We heard from Governor-elect J.B. Pritzker that he's not necessarily saying yes or no to a gas tax increase, but wants to look at a number of other alternatives. So we'll talk to Don Schaefer about that, infrastructure, gas taxes. After 8 o'clock, we'll speak to Tom Cross and Al Bowman of the Illinois Board of Higher Education. Tom Cross, a former Illinois House Republican leader, is chairman of the IBHE, and Al Bowman is the executive director. We're going to talk about the agency's recent funding request for the next budget year and whether things have stabilized in higher education now that we've got a state budget, and where there were a lot of concerns about out-migration of students to other universities out of state as a result of the state's two-year budget impasse. We'll see if the numbers have kind of stabilized on that. And then, after the 8:30 news update, we'll speak to another good friend of the program, Rebecca Shee. Rebecca is the executive director of the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition, and we'll talk to her about the federal debate over immigration policy, President Trump's demand that any government funding also include his request for funding for the border wall, something that he said he's prepared to shut down government unless he gets that funding. We'll also talk to her about where Governor-elect J.B. Pritzker fits into this whole immigration debate.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. Some good news, I guess. Mike Hammernick is reporting on his Twitter feed that the fog at Soldier Field will rapidly dissipate in the next hour. And I guess he must have been listening to me because he said, no, there was no repeat of the 1988 fog bowl today. Completely different scenario. He says sunny and 44 at kickoff at noon today as the Bears go on to win the division against the Packers today. Let's just put it forward like that. Quite a week in politics in Washington this week. So much for a holiday season, right? Trump's Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke quitting after multiple ethics investigation into him and his office and his business dealings. That after Trump announced that Mick Mulvaney, the director of OMB, Office of Management and Budget, is now acting chief of staff, although people aren't exactly sure what that means as John Kelly prepares to depart. News that a federal trial judge in Texas struck down Obamacare as unconstitutional, but that is certainly going to be appealed, and that does not have any national effect yet. And then, of course, we had the president's fixer, former personal attorney Michael Cohen, was sentenced to 3 years in prison after pleading guilty to lying investigators over the issue of hush money paid out to two women that Trump was alleged to have had dalliances with. In his plea, Cohen implicated Trump, and federal prosecutors implicated Trump, of wrongdoing to conceal something that he feared could affect the outcome of the election. Trump repeatedly tweeting out that Cohen's a liar, lying for a reduced sentence. But in his interview with George Stephanopoulos on ABC last week, Michael Cohen says that Trump is the liar and that no one believes what the president says. Here's Michael Cohen.
He knows the truth. I know the truth. Others know the truth. And here is the truth. The people of the United States of America, the people of the world, don't believe what he's saying. The man doesn't tell the truth. And it's sad that I should take responsibility for his dirty deeds.
So did Trump know that his actions to direct the paying off of these women to affect the outcome of the election was problematic? Here's more of George Stephanopoulos questioning Michael Cohen.
He's saying very clearly that he never directed you to do anything wrong. Is that true?
I don't think there's anybody that believes that. First of all, nothing at the Trump Organization was ever done unless it was run through Mr. Trump. He directed me, as I said in my allocution, and I said as well in the plea, he directed me to make the payments, he directed me to become involved in these matters, including the one with McDougal, which was really between him and David Pecker, and then David Pecker's counsel. I just reviewed the documents in order to protect him. I gave loyalty to someone who truthfully does not deserve loyalty.
He was trying to hide what you were doing, correct?
Correct.
And he knew it was wrong?
Of course.
And he was doing that to help his election?
You have to remember at what point in time that this matter came about, 2 weeks or so before the election, post the Billy Bush comments. So yes, he was very concerned about how this would affect the election.
That's Michael Cohen. Well, we're going to switch gears now on the Sunday Spin this morning. We're going to talk to my good friend Don Schaefer, Executive Vice President of the Midwest Truckers Association. We're going to talk about the issue of gasoline taxes, motor fuel taxes, sales taxes on gasoline, and ultimately, will we get an infrastructure program? Don, good morning.
Good morning, Rick. How are you?
I'm great, and looking forward to a Bears victory today, if you can't tell.
Yeah, at least there will not be a fog bowl today. No fog bowl.
Yes, we'll actually be able to see what's going on. I hope we want to see what's going on. Let me put it that way. So, Don, you heard Mayor Emanuel last week, along with some other mayors. Mayor Emanuel talking about wanting to see a 20 to 30 cent increase in the state's 19 cent per gallon motor fuel tax to help fund a massive infrastructure program in the state of Illinois. Gas tax is always a sensitive subject. That's probably why the state's 19 cent a gallon tax hasn't been raised since 1990. But, you know, is it time for a gas tax increase? And how does that affect your members?
No, I think everyone agrees that we have an infrastructure problem in Illinois, a lack of attention to the highways, bridges, local roads, and tie into it all the transportation modes that are affected by our low motor fuel tax in Illinois. You know, 19 cents is, at one time we had one of the highest gas taxes in the country. There's a gas tax. Of course, we have a surcharge for diesel fuel. But then also on top of it, you know, we have other taxes that go on to the what you pay at the pump. But now we're nowhere near the top. And our problem has been, as you said, since 1990, we have not been able to keep up with inflation in terms of maintaining our roads. You know, what we collect in motor fuel tax is basically the same that we collected 28 years ago. It hasn't changed that much. That's because even though we have a lot more vehicles on the road,
fuel efficiency,
better fuel mileage, and on top of that, you know, the rate of inflation. You know, the cost to build a road or to maintain a road has gone up dramatically in that time, and thus we haven't been able to keep up with inflation.
Should we do something about indexing the gas tax to inflation?
You know, if we had indexed the motor fuel tax 28 years ago, we wouldn't be talking about it today. We would have been able to keep up with the costs. And instead, what we're doing right now is instead of dealing with small incremental increases every year, which, you know, the public could probably, and the motorists, I could say, would, you know, could handle, instead, we're going to have to hit everybody with a wallop. And now we have a battle because the mayor comes out and says 20 to 30 cents. Other groups have come out and said, 10, 15 cents. And so we're going to have this big battle in Springfield over what actually is going to pass in terms of a new motor fuel tax increase. And then also, though, we got to deal with other issues. You know, we've got electronic vehicles, you know, electric cars, you know, the Teslas of the world that are going down the expressway. They don't pay motor fuel tax because they don't buy fuel. You'd have to deal with, you know, those types of situations because times are changing. And the tax structure that we put together 28 years ago does not address the 2018-2019 problems.
Well, there's a lot of speculation that the mayor maybe came out with that 20 to 30 cent
sure.
figure as a way to, you know, kind of provide some cover for a lower increase to be adopted. But a lower increase, you know, what does that buy?
Sure. I mean, 30 cents is an opening salvo. I think you have to shoot high because, you know, because in all reality, someone's going to throw a number up there and it's going to get beat up. And we understand that. And I think that there's going to be a lot of debate over what do we do. And there's a couple of things that are involved. Not only are we looking at the motor fuel tax, what is a number that we need to sustain or to improve our infrastructure? But number two, you know, there's other things that can be done. You know, we have a state sales tax on motor fuel. There's not many states in the country that what they do is that when you pay for your gas at the pump, they impose the price of the fuel. They put on the federal motor fuel tax and then the state motor fuel tax. But then they put a sales tax on top of the tax. So, you know, that generates hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And it goes into the state general fund. It does not go into the state road fund. So that's money that typically is lost that could be used for highway improvements, construction, or repair, that instead goes into the general fund that's used for some other type of state government program.
Right, the state's general bank account.
Right. So, I mean, you know, there are reforms that can be done. You know, that's important. And I think anyone will tell you that anyone who's going to negotiate a motor fuel tax increase, they're going to say, number one, if there's money that is collected on motor fuel, then it needs to go into road and bridge construction and repair. You know, we passed this lockbox amendment 2 years ago that was to guarantee that revenues that are collected are supposed to go into the road funds. Unfortunately, this was a situation where this was a sales tax and not a motor fuel tax, and thus it was not covered under the lockbox. Well, I think we need to see that changed and to put some truth in taxation out there. Because, you know, folks think that they're paying all this money at the pump, that it's going for roads and bridges, but it's not. So we need to take care of that, you know, one of the first things when they start talking and start negotiating the new motor fuel tax increase.
We're speaking with Don Schaefer, the Executive Vice President of the Midwest Truckers Association. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune. Just a weather update from Mike Hammernick over at the WGN Weather Center. O'Hare had a ground stop, but that has now been lifted, and the visibility is improving at O'Hare. Midway, though, still socked in. Many inbound flights canceled. So, obviously, if you're flying out or you're listening and and you were supposed to go somewhere, you better check with your airline this morning. Joining me now on the phone is rejoining me is Don Schaefer, my good friend, Executive Vice President of the Midwest Truckers Association. And we're talking about the issue of public works infrastructure repair bill and how we pay for it. And Don, I was curious about that issue about the sales tax and the lockbox amendment. And, you know, voters, if you remember, 2 years ago, you approved a change in the Illinois Constitution to kind of make sure that all money you pay for transportation-related expenses in this state go to build roads. And the sales tax on gasoline, which, as you said, applied after the state motor fuel tax, after the 18.4 cents a gallon federal tax, then you have a sales tax on top of it, and the sales tax goes to the general revenue fund, the state's checkbook. Obviously, this may not be a great time to be looking at taking revenues away from the general state checkbook, but at the same time, there is a great deal of need for an infrastructure repair bill. Illinois hasn't had one in a decade. And it's not like the gas tax necessarily would be the primary, well, it might be the primary funder, but it wouldn't be the only funding source. Isn't that pretty much, I mean, we paid for it out of last time with an increase in alcohol taxes and expanded video gaming. And I know J.B. Pritzker said, like, well, you know, everything's on the table here for this.
Well, and I think there's been some discussion also about increasing registration fees on vehicles, but I think that's usually one that is usually not very popular because that's kind of like a flat increase on everybody, and it's not a you know, a pay as you go type of a situation. Another discussion that has been out there is a thing called the VMT, the vehicle mile tax. There's been some talk about maybe the state instituting a vehicle mile tax as a means of raising money. In other words, you charge so much for every mile you drive. You know, our theory is on that, hey, that's a great concept. If you don't drive outside of the state of Illinois and you drive within a certain little area, a VMT maybe is something to think about. But, you know, we have a mobile population. They go to Wisconsin, Indiana, Illinois. They drive all across the country. How do you capture those miles if you're out of state? Those types of things. And, you know, I'm in the trucking industry. You know, that's the same type of situation. You know, how do you pay a tax that would be assessed if you're just in one state? VMT may be something to think about on the national level. There has been some discussion, you know, in the federal government talking about a nationwide VMT. The big thing is that the implementation of a VMT on a state level would be exorbitant. I mean, we're talking just the cost for setting up a department within the Illinois Department of Revenue to collect the vehicle mile tax, the transponders involved and all this. I mean, we're talking a $1 billion hit just to start a VMT. So I think a VMT is not being taken very seriously. I think more so, though, I think people are saying, I'm going to go back to this idea of indexing. Set a level. Set a base level for a motor fuel tax increase and then index it so we don't have to come back and deal with this issue on a recurring basis. You know, right now, Illinois needs, we'll need $6.6 billion right up front needed to keep the federal funding going for projects that we have going on right now. You know, that's a lot of money that we don't have, but we're going to have to address that. And, you know, Illinois has done every type of contortion to squeeze out federal money without increasing taxes over the years. You know, we've benefited from these, you know, how these projects are funded by the federal government oftentimes has been 90% from the federal government, 10% for state, 80-20, these types of federal funding projects. But now that's not the case anymore. You know, now it's being flipped around where the states have to come up with more match money to meet that federal project money. So the state's going to have to work real quick to come up with a bigger number, you know, to help keep going what we have and to deal with the, you know, just the growing list of problem areas and bridges and roadways and what have you.
Well, and yeah, we're, you know, we're primarily talking about roads and bridges, but when you look at, when we talk infrastructure, you're talking about much more than that. You're talking about mass transit, public transportation. We all have seen Kirk Dillard over at the RTA and the capital needs for Metra are tremendous.
And there's a lot of pressure. Yeah, and there's a lot of pressure being pushed, you know, in on that side, especially when you start dealing with, you know, groups that have chimed in already, like CMAP and others, who have said that, you know, mass transit, you know, they do, you know, they do us a favor by keeping cars off the road and those types of things. And to have a mass transit system that's, you know, that's operating correctly. Another component also is that we have to deal with is that, you know, when we collect motor fuel tax, you know, it doesn't all go to state government. You know, that trickles down to local units of government. Local units are screaming also, or I shouldn't say screaming, but pleading that the same thing is done because their hands are kind of tied when it comes to, you know, transit funding and to road and bridge repair because they put their hands out from the state and the state can only give them so much as much as they have. And to do anything else, they have to make it up on the local tax structure. So, yeah, it's not just state road. We aren't just talking state road construction. We're talking mass transit. We're talking even money going, you know, to roadways, going to
local roads,
other non-traditional, yeah, local roads, other non-traditional uses of transportation money. And they're all going to be addressed under this. And the day of reckoning is here. How's that sound?
There you go. There you go. Well, and of course, this is obviously an issue that we're going to be following. That's going to be a very important kind of issue with new governor, with J.B. Pritzker coming in. He's talked about the need for infrastructure. And it's all part of things that are on his agenda, his to-do list, and it's going to be very interesting to see how this works out.
Don, well, the attitude in Springfield is it something's going to happen. It has to happen now. We can't put it off any longer.
And it's a bipartisan attitude as well. Don Schaefer, Executive Vice President of the Midwest Truckers Association, thank you so much for joining me. Have a great holiday season.
Thanks, Rick.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. And joining me on the phone is Tom Cross, the chairman of the Illinois Board of Higher Education, and Al Bowman, the executive director of the IBHE. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Good to be here.
Good morning.
So I was curious about a couple of things here, and obviously you've been on the show before. We talked about the serious problems about out-migration of students, part of which the result of the a horrible two-year budget impasse that resulted in really such a lack of funding for higher education in this state. And I'm curious now that we've, you know, we're through the fall semester, we have a state budget again. Where do we stand, Tom, as far as that issue of out-migration? Is that subsided?
Well, I think I like to think we're turning the corner. I think what I think overall is we need, I believe, for parents and students to believe there's some certainty and some support and a commitment to higher education. And getting a budget passed last year was helpful. It is helpful, and I think it helps us say to those folks, hey, we're committed to higher education. But I still think there's room to improve. The governor-elect has talked about in increasing money for the MAP program. We certainly need to have a commitment and some action on capital. We need to make sure the operational budget passes. And so there's a lot of room to improve, but I think having a budget last year was a start. And Al, I'm sure you have a perspective too from a numbers standpoint on enrollment numbers.
Yeah, out-migration is still an artifact of life in Illinois, and it always has. We are typically the second or third largest out-migrator in the country. New Jersey is typically first. But I think the thing that's happened, as Tom mentioned, this year, is that with budget stability and predictability, I think families are beginning to regain some confidence in public higher ed in Illinois. Eastern Illinois University, as an example, this fall reported a 12% increase in their freshman class. And, you know, if a school in the central southern part of the state can turn their enrollment numbers around, it can be done anywhere.
Well, and Eastern being one of those schools that there were great deals of concern about, Eastern, Western, SIU Carbondale, schools that, you know, raised a great deal of concern about the viability for their future due to a lack of funding. So, I mean, where do those schools fit in, Western and Southern?
Yeah, Western and Southern are still fighting for enrollment, and I think they're both facing the reality that they need to balance revenues and expenditures, and so that will mean some more belt tightening. But I think that can be done in an organized, thoughtful way over the next couple of years. There certainly are enough students in Illinois to fill every available seat in our universities. And I think going forward with greater investment in our institutions and as the public regains confidence, I think we'll see that happen.
Well, for example, in fall of 2015, comparing Carbondale's enrollment from the fall of 2015 to the fall of 2018, they're down 28%. Western, from 2015 to 2018, is down 24% in its enrollment. I mean, those are huge numbers for big schools.
They are very large numbers, and they both of those institutions are trying to address the problem with better marketing, better recruitment practices, and if they're successful, they'll begin to recover those enrollments, but it's going to take a lot of hard work. The Carbondale campus, for example, has been losing enrollment since the 1990s, so this problem is not really related to the budget impasse.
Well, Alan, I know you're extremely familiar with Illinois State, but, I mean, Illinois State really static from 2015 to 2018. I mean, what was different there? I mean, you ran the place, you ran the shop. I mean, what's different there in keeping students and retaining students and attracting students versus the other schools?
You know, to use the retail analogy, you look at the fortunes of a company like Kmart and where Target is today. I think, you know, some organizations simply execute better, and they're able to withstand challenging circumstances better than other institutions. I think it's as simple as that.
And learning to adapt.
Right, exactly.
We're speaking with Tom Cross, chairman of the Illinois Board of Higher Education, and Al Bowman, its executive director. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Joining me on the phone is Tom Cross, the chairman of the Illinois Board of Higher Education, and IBHE Executive Director Al Bowman. We're talking about the state of higher education after what we saw from 2 years of state budget impasse. And I know now that the Board of Higher Ed earlier this month issued its recommended budget request for the budget year that begins on July 1st of next year, seeking $314 million new dollars, or a 16.6% increase in funding that's for higher education in Illinois. And gentlemen, I mean, 16.6% sounds like a lot of money here.
Well, it's for the state schools, from an operating standpoint, it's a 10% increase. I think to put it in perspective, not only have you had the struggles over the last few years with significantly reduced budgets, but compare it to where we were as a state in 2002. Our budget was for higher ed was about 2.4. This year it'll be 2.2. So we have seen a significant reduction in commitment to higher ed over that period of time. So this is an attempt to not only, I'll use that term, predictability and certainty, but also to try to start that climb back up of a commitment financially to the universities here in Illinois.
And I know that there's recommended increases, Al, like for the monetary award program, that MAP program, which was so devastated by the budget impasse. Also, $20 million for that AIM High program. And could you refresh us again on AIM High?
The AIM High program is a merit-based scholarship program. We're trying to go back to the days when we recognized student performance with a scholarship that could be used in Illinois, and we've gotten away from that obviously in recent years. But this is a small step toward trying to retain some of those high achieving students who are leaving the state. There are income requirements. They are a bit more generous than they are with the MAP program. So this is a scholarship that would be available to students from middle class families. It would not be available to students from wealthy families, but we felt like it needed to reach into the middle class and to try to provide support for those kids.
When, as Tom just mentioned about the fact that when you go back to 2002 when the higher ed budget was like $2.5 billion and you guys are looking at a request to get it to $2.2 billion, and in that time period, you know, we've kind of seen, I think, just this general lack of prioritizing higher ed when it comes to state funding, that it wasn't like the old days of, and I think we've referred to this before, I mean, when I covered state government going back from the 80s, that any new monies that the state got from revenue growth, two-thirds went to elementary and secondary education, and higher education got the other third, and that all seemed to go away. Particularly, I think, when Rod Blagojevich took over as governor. But it seems like there's just been that general deprioritization of higher ed. Are you confident that the new governor, J.B. Pritzker, will be trying to make a recommitment to higher education and also follow it up with the state resources to do that?
Well, on that note, use MAP as an example. Today, MAP is we fund about 40% of what we really need. We have, as you mentioned, we have a $100 million increase. But even if that was accepted, we'd still we'd still be significantly lower than the needs that exist here in the state of Illinois. And I think that it would help us on out-migration to take that number to a different level. My sense is, I haven't talked to him, but listening to the governor-elect and during his campaign, there seems to be a commitment, and I believe there's a commitment to higher ed, because he recognizes some of the needs and concerns we have, one of those being MAP. And as he said, we need to have an increase in MAP.
Tom, just interrupt. Why don't you explain what the monetary award program is?
Well, it's a monetary assistance program, and it's designed, generally speaking, to help lower-income students here in the state of Illinois. We fund about $400 million we did in the last budget that the General Assembly did, $400 million to the MAP program. And in reality, we need about $900 million. So it's gone up the last couple of years a bit, but it needs to go up significantly. Again, one of those areas, not just on operating, that has gone down or has not stayed level with where it was a number of years ago. One of the other things that you didn't mention, but I think helps on the out-migration issue, is not only was AIM High, there was funded last year, there's a proposal to refund it again this year in the IBEH budget, IBEH budget. There's also a suggested proposal to provide a grant program for private institutions that for a number of years was in the budget. It'd be similar. We'd have to work. We still have to work on the details. The General Assembly needs to work on the details. But it's similar to AIM High in a different way. But it's a grant program that existed and had not been funded for a number of years. And there's a belief that will also help on the out-migration issue.
That's the $25 million that is in the budget for assistance for non-public institutions? Grants?
Correct.
So, Dr. Bowman, I mean, what optimism do you have, or if any, on with the new administration and the issue of reprioritization of higher ed?
I am optimistic. I think the positive comments that were made about higher ed and the commitment to higher ed during the campaign, I think, are resonating throughout the higher ed community. Obviously, one of the things that has to happen is we have to grow the Illinois economy. And, looking at state revenues this year, there's been some very positive growth. State revenues are up about 12% year to date. And if we can sustain that throughout the fiscal year, that'll be a step in the right direction. That, I think, in the long run, growing the economy, allowing the state to generate enough revenue to meet its priorities, that's what it will take to create real change in higher ed. I became president of Illinois State University in 2003, and so for the next 10 years, I watched our state support decline year over year to the point where tuition today covers 70% of university operations, whereas back in 2002, tuition covered 30% of university operations.
Right.
So there's a one-to-one relationship between state support and tuition charges.
And that's why tuition skyrocketed, and with the deprioritization of higher ed. And I mean, let's face it, the tuition is a tremendous hurdle today.
In addition to that, the reality is that the state, when you look at the entire basket of expenditures on higher ed, it's a lot of money. But over $1.6 billion of that higher ed budget is going to the state university retirement system, and 75% of that $1.6 billion is to pay old pension debt. And so, our overarching problem is generating enough revenue to retire the old pension debt and have enough money to fund ongoing operations.
And similar issues with the rest of state government as well. Tom Cross, chairman of the Illinois Board of Higher Education, Dr. Al Bowman, the executive director of the IBHE. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me this morning. Have a great holiday season.
And let's get a Bears win today.
There you go. Thanks, Al. We'll be back with more right after this.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Last week, President Trump met with House Speaker-designate Nancy Pelosi and Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer of New York to discuss government continuing government funding. They also discussed the president's demand for border wall funding in order to prevent a government shutdown. Trump says he's happy to wear the jacket for a shutdown because he believes the public wants border funding. Here's some of that conversation with Chuck Schumer starting.
I think we can agree on is we shouldn't shut down the government over a dispute. And you want to shut it down. You keep talking about it.
The last time, Chuck, you shut it down.
No.
And then you opened it up very quickly. And
20 times.
I don't want to do what you did.
20 times, Chuck, you have called for, I will shut down the government if I don't get my wool. None of us have
said. You want to know something?
You've said it.
Okay, you want to put that
on my...
You
said it.
I'll take it.
Okay, good.
You know what I'll say? Yes. If we don't get what we want, one way or the other, whether it's through you, through a military, through anything you want to call, I will shut down the government.
Okay, absolutely. Fair enough.
And
we
I am
disagree.
Proud, and I'll
we
tell
disagree.
You what, I am proud to shut down the government for border security, Chuck, because the people of this country don't want criminals and people that have lots of problems and drugs pouring into our country. So I will take the mantle. I will be the one to shut it down. I'm not going to blame you for it. The last time you shut it down, it didn't work. I will take the mantle
Good.
Of shutting down.
That is
and I'm going to shut it down for border
security. But we
security.
Believe you shouldn't.
So Trump says he'll wear the jacket for a shutdown of government. And that's something clearly that other Republicans in Congress don't want to see happen. Here's Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky.
I hope that's not where we end up. I understand it was a rather spirited meeting we all watched, but I'd still like to see a smooth ending here, and I haven't given up hope that that's what we'll have.
Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Skyline studio is Rebecca Shee. Rebecca is the executive director of the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Oh, thank you, Rick, for having me, and congratulations on your beautiful studio.
I wish it was mine. I don't own it, but I enjoy sitting in here, although I do miss the old streetscape of Michigan
right.
Avenue.
Yeah.
But yes, beautiful view over the 18th floor overlooking Navy Pier. So we keep hearing this debate going on and the government shutdown possible, Trump wanting $5 billion for his wall. But we also, last week, I talked about a poll that was conducted by Grinnell University, which found that the public really was, you know, they're more welcoming than what necessarily we hear from the administration when it comes from immigration. But that is not stopping the president.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And in addition to the Grinnell poll that you cited, I think that this midterm elections is a testament to the reality that a majority of Americans are very welcoming and would like to see our country to be more welcoming of immigrants and refugees. And, we know that there's been a lot of talk about and data that show that how suburban women from across the country, including Illinois' collar counties, left the Republican Party during this midterm election. And looking at the Roscom and Holkern races, their unwillingness to embrace immigrants and immigration reform played into why those districts flipped as well. And so as we're looking forward to this month and next year, the quotes that you just played, neither the Republican leadership in both chambers are willing to continue to play this rhetoric and these anti-immigrant, anti-refugee sentiments that the president continues to communicate. And so, both McConnell and Ryan have said, where would we find the votes to, basically make into reality the president's shutdown strategy. And so, you know, we are generally optimistic about this coming year because we think that, as we've seen across the country, there are more and more Americans are willing to stand up and say, hey, you know, let's go back to the bedrock and values of our country as a nation of immigrants.
Well, you touched on Paul Ryan, and I always found it interesting that, you know, it wasn't that long ago that at the City Club of Chicago, you had Paul Ryan and Luis Gutierrez together talking about the need for immigration reform. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But then we see the evolution of Ryan as becoming Speaker of the House, Republican leader of the U.S. House, and all of that talk went away.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, that just seemed to be, you know, reflective of where the party was going even before Donald Trump. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And when the City Club event took place with Paul Ryan and Congressman Gutierrez, that was under Speaker Boehner's leadership. And as you recall, when Speaker Boehner was leaving office, he said his number one regret was not being able to pass comprehensive immigration reform. And as we're seeing Speaker Ryan leave office last week, Politico, The Hill reported that he talked about his top regret was not passing immigration reform. And so, you know, we think that for this coming years, you know, with the House being under a Democrat controlled, you know, incoming likely Speaker Pelosi already, you know, put out press releases and spoken publicly about a top priority will be passing a DREAM Act. So I think that will help to build a positive momentum in actually getting a sensible immigration legislation done in the coming years.
Well, is it your view that part of that midterm in the House, the switchover from Republican to Democrat, you had the president talking about the caravan coming up to the border and, you know, sending military to the border. That kind of strategy of politicalization of against immigrants, that backfired?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, speaking to the polls that you mentioned, we've seen exit polls and then later deeper analysis of who actually came out to vote and why. Suburban women, you know, across the board spoke to how the splitting up of families at the border, the demonizing of immigrants and the expanded deportation across the board contributed to why they voted for Democrats in this last election when they 2 years prior had voted for their Republican congressman or President Donald Trump. And additionally, we saw an increase enlarging of the electorate, especially among Latinos and Asians and immigrant voters. Nationally, we saw a jump of about 170% among Latino voters and about over 200% of Asian American voters. So, you know, we see a lot of times these electorates undervote or do not vote during midterm elections, and that was
or elections in particular,
or elections in general. Exactly. So
but how much of that was motivation because of the politicalization over migrant policies, and how much of it was driven by organizations to try to spur that activity?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that this was one of the kind of narratives that broke through in the public, in the mainstream psyche, is the idea that, you know, if you're unhappy about what's going on, about the splitting up the families, about, you know, for us, our employers not being able to find labor and fill these available positions, then you have to make your voices heard at the polls. So, you know, across the country, including those in Illinois, there was a very energized GOTV effort across the board and voter registration and, you know, even just the rate of naturalization, people that want to become citizens and have for years just renewed their green card, it jumped, you know, including my mom. So my mom became a U.S. citizen right before the 4th of July and voted for the first time this November. And so, yeah, I think that was a huge, huge contributing factor.
We're speaking with Rebecca Shee, the executive director of the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Skyline studio, joined by Rebecca Shee, the executive director of the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition. We're talking about immigration policy and politics. And Rebecca, obviously the news over the last couple of days about a 7-year-old Guatemalan girl who died in the custody of U.S. Customs and Border Protection. NBC reporting that this 7-year-old waited an hour and a half before receiving emergency medical care after showing symptoms. It's kind of interesting because this is very tragic, obviously, very tragic. But then you have people in the White House, in the administration, saying, well, this shows the dangers of trying to immigrate illegally into the United States, and that's the dangers that exist for children in these caravans, which also raises the specter, but what does that say about the desire of these parents to want their children to have a better life than where they live now, like in Guatemala? I mean, that seems to be what the tension is.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, so the father and his daughter, they were part of this group that willingly turned themselves in to ICE, to CBP, the Border Patrol, and, you know, under our existing law, people have the ability to apply for asylum, have their cases heard and adjudicated. So,
and this is in a legal process. This is not trying to cross the border illegally. They submitted themselves as seeking asylum.
No, that's exactly it. So they were following our current rule of law, So I think that's number one, that they were trying to do the right thing, and this, you know, incredible tragedy resulted. And number two, I mean, to your point about that overwhelming desire for the next generation, I mean, this isn't new, right? This is the same story that we've heard when Paul Ryan was at the City Club many years ago, speaking to how his grandparents, who were potato farmers in Ireland, you know, came to this country. And, you know, and he even admitted at that time, probably without papers, and came to Wisconsin and farmed and were dairy farmers. So now, you know, today their grandson is the Speaker of the House. It's the same story that Governor-elect Pritzker shared about his grandfather, who came here with no money and basically built an empire for their family. And his grandson is the governor of Illinois. And so, you know, I think people's desire for, as you said, for the future generation to do better than themselves and to thrive will not diminish. This family did everything right to try to, you know, be within the rule of law.
Now, you mentioned Governor-elect Pritzker. You featured him recently at an event. And obviously, he is more outspoken in his wanting to make Illinois a welcoming state versus Governor Rauner, who, I mean, kind of sent mixed messages when it came to the issue of immigration. You know, at one point, you know, was we don't want Syrian refugees, you know, following a Trump kind of mandate. But also, you know, he signed the Trust Act, which and then took a lot of heat for it, and then tried to distance himself from the Trust Act. And why don't you just explain what the Trust Act is?
Sure. So the Illinois Trust Act prohibits local law enforcement from carrying out immigration duties, and you know, someone, an immigrant, cannot be arrested or detained unless there is a judicial warrant signed by a judge. And so,
and basically, you can't be detained solely on the basis of your legal status.
Exactly. And the reason that we and our businesses and employers and people like, you know, Sam Toya from the Restaurant Association was a big champion for this bill is that over the last 2 years, you know, we've seen this increase in workplace raids and increase in I-9 audits. And Department of Homeland Security's own data show that they've increased these workplace rates by about 400%. And so this is creating incredible disruption to our workforce, split up families, and contributed to this growing labor shortage. So, you know, we double down, and I think that really helped to get Republicans on the board, but really, you know, convinced Governor Rauner to sign this. And I think that the kind of, as you mentioned, the back and forth or his kind of communication and opinion on this bill, you know, really hurt him during the elections, and it became an issue during the primary, and it hurt, split the party, the Republican Party, and it, I think, really hurt the party this last midterms. And so, you know, we're look forward to working with Governor-elect J.B. Pritzker. As you mentioned, I think he's putting out a very aspirational agenda about making Illinois a welcoming state for all immigrants, both high-skilled and low-skilled. You know, this last Friday, we had an event hosted by Tom Cross and Dr. Sherrick at Aurora University, and just the amount of students that stood up and students that were majoring in computer science or going into nursing who have DACA, and the fear and the, you know, just questions about their future. I mean, it was tragic, and I think that having, you know, a strong executive at the top that's pushing for sensible immigration reform for a DREAM Act this year, you know, would be incredibly helpful. So
when you mentioned that event to me off air, and you mentioned Congressman Bill Foster from Naperville was there, but you also mentioned about how there has been some very strict enforcement going on in kind of that Aurora, St. Charles kind of area. Could you fill us in on what was going on there?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, over the summer, there was several businesses, restaurants and grocery stores that had I-9 audits and also workplace raids, and over 150 immigrants were detained. And really, thanks to the leadership of Congressman Foster's office, the Illinois Restaurant Association, and, you know, nearly all of them were able to be released and, you know, back to their community and contributing and working. But it spread incredible fear across the region. I mean, to the point, our employers in the area have said that, you know, we're just being squeezed. We can't find workers for these available positions. One of our manufacturers has over 80 positions that are open. They start at $15.50 an hour that they can't find workers. And they said, you know, it's we see this, that there's just fear in the immigrant community, the Latino community, to even come forward and apply for these jobs that we haven't seen before. And so something that we've been doing with our employers, including our forum on Friday, was that, you know, we want to educate them on, number one, how do you become compliant under the current immigration law? But really, number two, what are your rights as employers in the case of an I-9 audit or an ICE raid? And, you know, so number one is that if ICE comes knocking, you do have 72 hours before you hand over all of your I-9 audit, I-9 forms. And, you know, we are here to help you to kind of go through every one of your I-9s and work with you and your employees to create a protection plan for their families, but also to help you so that it minimizes your penalties. I mean, we've seen ICE penalize employers up to $28,000 per person. So, you know, we're also there to help businesses. So anyways, yeah, I mean, we, you know, talking to Sam this last week, and, you know, he said this in the Tribune too, the hospitality industry is going to be, I think, in one of the worst situations because, you know, if a bill like, you know, legalizing marijuana passes, the same workforce might shift over to that industry, and the hospitality restaurant industry, you know, cannot fill their back of the house or dishwashers or waiters. So,
well, obviously, this topic continues to be of great interest. Rebecca Shee, Executive Director of the Illinois Business Immigration Coalition, as always, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you so much for having me, Rick.